On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the new view of the Palestinian crisis bubbling out of Washington. Hamas took Gaza by the gun, so let them have it. And pour resources into the West Bank, where more moderate Palestinians around Mahmoud Abbas remain in charge. Let the West Bank bloom, let Gaza wither, and then let Palestinians choose. Longtime Hamas and Hezbollah watcher Augustus Richard Norton calls this a fantasy. Hamas, he says, must be engaged, even now. Critics say that ignores a titanic struggle already playing out in the Middle East. Up next, On Point, what to do about Hamas. We will hear in this hour from a strong advocate of a hard line with Hamas. But first, joining me now is Augustus Richard Norton. He spent the last year in the Middle East, Egypt, Lebanon, Israel, and more. He's an authority on Islamic groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, West Point professor, military observer for the United Nations in Lebanon, was an advisor to the Iraq study group just back from the Middle East. Augustus Richard Norton, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
You've written recently and very pointedly that Washington, you say, is engaged in a fantasy if it seems to want to define the West Bank as the good Palestinians, Gaza and Hamas now as the bad, and operate from that point. Why a fantasy?
Well, it's just not going to work, Tom. It's that simple. The fact of the matter is that, number one, Hamas has strong roots not only in Gaza but in the West Bank. Number two, there is a strong sentiment amongst the Palestinians for the creation of an independent state, the so-called two-state solution, side by side with Israel, with East Jerusalem as the capital. This is not a consensus around the West Bank as the Palestinian state, but Gaza and the West Bank. And if the new Palestinian government in Ramallah, under President Mahmoud Abbas, seems to be moving in a direction which basically truncates Gaza and leaves it to suffering, and I might point out that in Gaza you have 80% or more of the population living under the basically the starvation level of income. If this is the outcome, then we're going to see an ally in Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas, who's basically discredited and delegitimated in the eyes of his own people.
But what brought us to this point? You turn it directly back to January 2006, elections among the Palestinians and victory for Hamas.
Well, look, President Bush has been promoting democracy for the last several years. He's been a strong advocate of democracy in the Arab world, and I think aptly so. Sometimes I think his advocacy, though, is a little bit like what I would call the Thomas Jefferson solution. You give him two democracy tablets at bedtime, and then wake up the next morning as Democrats. Doesn't work that way. Basically, we have enunciated a position. Elections were held which were described by the U.S. as a day of celebration for the Palestinian people, a day in which they could basically enjoy their will at the ballot box, a day of elections that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice described as peaceful and fair. And after the election, when we got the results we didn't like, when our friends didn't win the election, we set about, instead of trying to basically find some way of moving Hamas in a more pragmatic direction, instead we set out to undermine this government. Spent at least $84 million, that's as much as I can document right now, to build militia forces and military forces to defeat Hamas. And in fact, it was those very same forces that were defeated in Gaza earlier this month. So basically, we have talked the talk, but we haven't walked the walk when it comes to democratization. I can tell you from across the Middle East, at least those places where I've spent a lot of time, that this position has really evoked very, very widespread charges of hypocrisy and worse against the United States. It's really discredited the U.S. as an advocate for political reform and democratization in the region.
But if there's a contradiction there, if there's hypocrisy there, what about in the Palestinian camp? You say Palestinians tend to favor a two-state solution, ultimately. On the other hand, They elected Hamas, which has not accepted the existence of Israel. That doesn't sound like a two-state solution.
Well, first of all, let me say that we have very rich polling data now on the Palestinian people. And what we see is that whether you're polling Hamas supporters or the supporters of groups opposed to Hamas, we see a robust support for the two-state solution, number one. Number two, we have had a number of statements from Hamas officials basically saying that they will accept a two-state solution if it comes to that outcome. They have also talked about a long-term hudna, or ceasefire with Israel, in terms of 10 or 15 years. That may not be a formal two-state solution, but it would certainly be the evolution of two distinct political entities over time. So I don't think it's quite correct to say that Hamas has basically rejected the two-state solution. There has been, basically, an incremental process of change going on in Hamas. This has been in some cases, sabotaged by the Israeli assassination of Hamas officials, some of whom have been more pragmatic in orientation, Ron Sisi, for example. But nonetheless, this is the trajectory that is marked not just in the Hamas street, if you will, but in the Palestinian street.
So which way, though, is U.S. policy headed right now? Does it look to you as though we're going to move ahead with this West Bank good, Gaza and Hamas bad strategy? How would that practically work, and what outcome do you predict if that's the direction that everything takes?
Well, a lot depends on what the U.S. is willing to deliver. The President of the United States, George Bush, has declared his commitment to a two-state solution. Fine and dandy. However, he's not done anything to back it up. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been out in the region at various points, talking to the Israeli government and other interlocutors in the region, talking about a political horizon, talking about negotiations in the Arab-Israeli context and so on. But there's been no backup. In fact, it's been documented in the Israeli press that we have actually NSC officials who have been calling the Prime Minister's office in Israel in conjunction with Rice's visits and saying, don't sweat it, don't worry about it, it's not serious. So it's a little bit like a situation where George Bush is the star relief pitcher. He's a great pitcher. We know he's got good stuff when he wants to use it. He's out in the bullpen, it's late in the game, and they call out to the bullpen, send in the star reliever, send in the decider. And he says, I'm not playing today. The president has been absent without leave when it comes to pushing this process along.
But circumstances on the ground have changed, and now you have, you know, a divided Palestinian community geographically.
That's right. It's a very difficult situation, Tom.
Will it be possible to pour millions into the West Bank, pour just subsistence into Gaza, build a flowering West Bank that stands as the symbol of all that can be good and beautiful about this relationship, and let Gaza, I don't know, rot?
Well, I think you more or less answered your own question. It won't work, and it certainly won't wash
Why
with the
not?
Palestinians. Palestinians have a good nose for this kind of thing, and basically you are not going to see Mahmoud Abbas sustaining his political support if that's the outcome. People have relatives in Gaza. They know what's going on. They're tuned into the news and so on. So if you have a situation where Gaza is going to sink deeper into impoverishment, if it's going to sink deeper into suffering, this is not going to produce an outcome that we are going to be happy with or that Israel is going to be happy with. And that's an absolute certainty. So let's see if the U.S. is willing to walk the walk in terms of providing serious support for Mahmoud Abbas, but also ensuring that the people of Gaza see some relief to their suffering. If that means in the process that Hamas makes some political gains, that's not necessarily a bad thing. We need to pull these groups to the center. And I'm very worried right now, I must say. There's been a region-wide debate and discussion going on amongst Islamists since the early 1990s. Lots of Islamist groups talking about the fact that they need to basically focus on questions of pluralism and toleration. And they need to basically think about how they play within the political game. And in one case after another, we see Islamist groups that are basically finding the door slammed in their face. And this basically is a recipe for a situation where we'll see more extreme groups, Salafi groups who basically have total contempt for democracy and so on, prospering. And may I just say one other thing about the disastrous situation in Iraq? Many people, policymakers in the Arab world, policy intellectuals, journalists, and so on, are very worried about the fact that you have a phenomenon now of lots of terrorists, lots of violent people being trained in Iraq from the Arab world, from places like Egypt, Libya, Jordan, and so on. And they're at certain points going to be going home. We have a sample of what happens when they go home from the period following the fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s against the Soviet Union. These so-called Arab Mujahideen, or Arab Afghans, as they were sometimes called, went back to their countries, Algeria, Egypt, and so on, and made one gigantic mess of violence and terrorism. So we need to think about pulling these groups into the process that are willing to be pulled into the process. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves with a much less attractive alternative in the future.
Can Hamas really be pulled into a process? Is it an independent player, or is it just an extension of Syrian strategic goals, Iranian strategic goals, unlikely or perhaps definitely not ready to compromise, to play ball?
This is quintessentially a Palestinian organization. There has been Iranian support, particularly for another Islamist group, the Islamic Jihad. There has been some support for Hamas. But essentially, this is a quintessentially Palestinian group that has been at pains to distinguish itself, for example, from Al-Qaeda. It does have roots, for example, in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which has been moving also in a very moderate direction, I might underline, despite the fact that hundreds of members of the Ikhwan have been arrested by our ally, Egypt, and thrown in jail, basically on no charges at all.
Mm-hmm. We've been joined by Augustus Richard Norton of Boston University, author of Hezbollah, A Short History. He's just back from a year all over the Middle East, an authority on Hezbollah and Hamas. We're joined right now from Washington by Mayrav Wurmser, Director for Middle East Studies at the Hudson Institute in Washington, author of Building Free Societies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mayrav Wurmser, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You have a very different view of what's playing out on this chessboard in the Middle East. You've heard Augustus Richard Norton's view. We must engage, he says. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that we cannot and should not and must not engage Hamas. This is not a question of choice, really. This is a question of what these people stand for. When I look at the Hamas covenant, for example, they state in there, no non-Muslim must ever step on any part of Muslim land, and if he does, we will kill him. Namely, this doesn't have to do just with Israel. This also has to do with the U.S. presence in Iraq, with our liberation of Kuwait, with anything. Anytime a non-Muslim steps foot on, you know, on the Middle East. Now, they've proven what they mean by that. On June 19th, just after the revolt began in the West Bank, they have attacked Christians.
In the West Bank or Gaza, May Wormser? You mean
In Gaza.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They looted and torched the Rosary Sister Covenant and school in Gaza. No apparent reason. These are Christians who did nothing to them. The problem with Hamas is that it is a terrorist organization. It is not accepting the two-state solution. Again, I'm looking at their covenant, and it says here, initiatives and so-called peaceful solution in international conferences are in contradiction to the principles of the Islamic resistance movement. They state this. This is from their covenant. You know, there's not much we can do about making these people more moderate. They are in opposition to the West. They need to be fought.
You have made the argument recently in the Weekly Standard, I've been reading here, that beyond that, Hamas is not really an independent player. It is an extension of the foreign policy, the regional strategy of Syria and Iran. How? Why?
Yeah, these days we see a major strategic realignment in the region. I think that what we see now is that Syria and Iran have, in fact, declared war on us in the Levant. This has begun, a year ago when they declared war in Lebanon via the Hezbollah on Israel. Hezbollah is a Syrian and Iranian agent. Now they're trying to renew it through the fighting in the Palestinian camps in Lebanon against the democratically elected and pro-Western government of Lebanon. They are backing Fatah al-Islam in those Palestinian camps, which is an al-Qaeda-like group that is opposed to the government and is trying to bring Syria back in control of Lebanon.
When you say
at the same time, they've started a revolt. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to clarify, when you say Syria and Iran have declared war on us, what do you mean by us?
Us, the United States, us, the West, us and Israel.
By their moves in the Levant or Lebanon and Israel and Gaza.
Lebanon, Israel, I think Jordan is next as well. And so, you know, at the same time, so happens, you know, Hamas, which gets most of its funding nowadays from Iran and which is controlled and commanded from Damascus, also revolts. And takes over Gaza. I don't think this will end in Gaza. I don't think that we will have what Washington is hoping for, which is an optimal situation in which these guys take over Gaza and these guys take over the West Bank. I think the fighting will continue and will spread to the West Bank. From Gaza, they threaten Egypt, they threaten Israel, and they can, once they spread into the West Bank, also threaten Jordan. So we have a major destabilization of all of our allies by these people, all of whom are agents of Syria and Iran.
Mayrav Wormser, stand by. I want to hear you and Augustus Richard Gordon engage on this. These are pretty polar opening positions, and yet people have to do real work on the ground in trying to put policy together. Augustus Richard Norton, you hear the argument. Cannot, should not, must not engage with Hamas. It's terrorist. It's a paw of Syria and Iran, and it's a threat to the whole region, for that matter, the West.
Yes, I hear the claim, but, you know, to begin with, to argue that what a group says at one point or another is somehow some sort of permanent indication of behavior is just fallacious empirically. In the late 80s, I was part of a fact-finding team that went to Mozambique, far away from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. We went to look at the conditions for a UN force there. I've spent a lot of time in combat zones, I think 3.5 years in combat zones and war zones. It's one of the worst places I've ever been. At that point, a group called RENAMO was doing literally unspeakable things to people.
Mm-hmm.
It was inconceivable at that point in time that RENAMO could become part of any kind of legitimate government. Now, if you go to Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, you find RENAMO really comprising the opposition in the legislature.
So groups change, they regularize, they normalize, but bring it home to the Middle East. Mayrav Wormser says Iran and Syria have a big agenda here. It's a confrontational agenda. Hamas is just part of that. Even if it wants to change, it would not be encouraged, she suggests.
Look, there are lots of contentious claims here. I mean, the Hamas funding, my understanding is a tremendous amount of that money is coming from Saudi Arabia, not from Iran. And basically, I'd like to see the data that backs up those claims, and I'd be happy to look at it. I believe in data and empiricism. In terms of the Iranian-Syrian support for Fatah al-Islam, same thing. Where is the evidence for this? Indeed, what we've seen, for example, in Lebanon, in terms of Fatah al-Islam in the fighting north of Tripoli in Lebanon, is a virtual consensus in Lebanon amongst Christians, Sunnis, the Iran leading Hezbollah and so on against Fatah al-Islam and in favor of the Lebanese army. So
that is not
let me finish, please, and I'll let you finish. What I'd like to see is the evidence. The fact of the matter is that, number one, organizations change. Number two, it happens to be the fashion in Washington that people can get away with lots of outrageous claims about adversaries with very little data. I'd like to see the data.
Mayor of Wormser.
Well, sure. About Fatah al-Islam, I'll be glad to show you the data. All you have to do is look at Hezbollah's statements PFLP Central Command statements that are completely in support of Fatah al-Islam. Very interesting coming from a Shiite radical group like Hezbollah that all of a sudden it's in support of the Sunni radical al-Qaeda-like cell. of Fatah al-Islam, isn't it? It's very interesting, and the statements are very sort of, you know, brow-raising, exactly because one should not see this kind of support unless both of them are working for the same boss, which in this case, we know they do, and it is Syria.
Organizations change. What about that, Mayrav Wormser?
Organizations don't change. Maybe the PLO serves
Augustus
Rich
Norton
the best.
He cites an example where he saw it happen. Is this?
I can cite an example when I saw it not happen,
yeah.
And that example is Palestinian, no less. Let's look at Fatah and the PLO. The PLO did say that it recognizes Israel, after which the Oslo agreements were signed, after which they have received something that is in the process of becoming was in the process of becoming a state. And then for all the years since, we have seen that despite what was supposed to be a change, we had Yasser Arafat continuing to call for jihad, sending his people to blow up and commit terrorism against Israel. We saw that, he wasn't able to stop. He and his organizations could not stop supporting terrorism. Or in fact, call for jihad and the killing of Jews and the destruction of Israel.
So where does that observation take you? Are you then against even the two-state solution? Palestinians don't change, so no deal can be done?
Well, Palestinian society and what happened with the Palestinians really, I think, has caused us or is highlighted very strongly the problematic nature of the conflict. Because until both people change and until we have a real change of heart and real peacefulness, and maybe Abu Mazen is it finally, it's you can't really talk about that much movement.
But that's not what you're pointing to so much in your Weekly Standard essay. One of the headlines is The Coming War. It sounds as though you're describing a kind of, regional Armageddon. Inevitably.
Armageddon, I don't know. A limited conflict in the near future, yeah.
Where? Centered where? Beyond Iraq, presumably. Where? What?
Beyond Iraq, somewhere in the Levant.
Meaning Lebanon or on the soil of Israel or
Lebanon,
the West Bank and Gaza war?
Lebanon or Israel or the West Bank and Gaza, or there are a gazillion scenarios that could play here, all of which have some violence, unfortunately, involved in them. This isn't something optimal. This isn't something we want to see. This is something that is really heartbreaking in a lot of ways. But, that's the region in which America now finds itself. And the more realistic we are, maybe the better we can protect ourselves.
Augustus Richard Norton, where do you see realism here?
Well, look, I go back to the 1930s during the period of the so-called Arab Revolt. Look at the work, for example, of the Israeli scholar Benny Morris. What do we see? We see basically the forebears of Israel's Likud party, which now basically enjoys great power and privilege in Israel, basically launching bombings against civilian areas, Palestinian areas, really anticipating many of the kinds of violence, acts of violence we see in Iraq. If I were to take my co-host's position, I would argue that the Likud types, the members of the Zionist revisionist movement, who are responsible for those bombings, would never change, then how could I possibly understand what's happening in Israel and has happened for the last half century? If I were to go back to the 1940s, and I were to look at the activity of people like Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin, who were aptly described as terrorists by the British, how would I possibly explain the role that they later came to play as legitimate politicians in Israel? Of course things are not frozen in time. They change. And on the prospects for conflict, perhaps. But, you know, I can imagine a gazillion things, too. I mean, I'm a golfer. I can conceive of a golf match where I beat Tiger Woods. It's not very likely to happen. I'm much more interested in talking about events on the basis of probability and likelihood, rather than these sort of amorphous comments about the Middle East being a dangerous place. They just don't take us anywhere.
Let's go to our callers. That's someplace we can go. Mazen's calling from Orange, Connecticut. Mazen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me on the call. I'm a Palestinian. My family is Palestinian Christian. And actually, in the last election, many of my relatives had voted for Hamas because, as you know, the West Bank and Gaza are 22% of Palestine. And most of us are refugees or displaced people. 80% of Palestinians are refugees or displaced people. 530 Palestinian villages were demolished when the State of Israel was created, and people were ethnically cleansed. And now what's left is basically living in prisons called the West Bank and Gaza.
So, Mazen, did your family vote for Hamas because they want to take back territory from Israel?
They want to vote for somebody who's willing to resist the occupation because they realize that what Fatah has done in negotiations has not achieved them anything, has not achieved them the freedom, the liberation, the right to return to their homes and lands. So they decide, like people in the prison, they vote for the tough guy, so to speak. They vote for the tough guy.
But do you support Hamas now, Mazen?
No, I don't support Hamas personally. I believe in human rights and I believe in freedom. But what I'm saying is when the U.S. sends billions of dollars of aid to Israel to continue the occupation over years of negotiations without achieving a single thing that's tangible in terms of return of refugees or in terms of removing the, you know, returning our land that was stolen from us, then of course people get frustrated, and that's understandable. What I'm saying is that the U.S. has the key to this issue. It's not back there because we are the one who are funding it and we are the one who keep it going, and with institutions like the Hudson Institute being essentially an Israeli proxy institute, then what is the function of this government? Cannot have freedom of movement. Read Jimmy Carter's book on Palestine, peace, not apartheid, to understand some of the issues.
Mazen, thank you very much for your call. Mayrav Wurmser, kind of behind these two comments from our caller and from Augustus Richard Norton from different angles, is the message that, you know, you will kind of get what you imagine in this region. And if you imagine war and set up for it, that's what you'll get. But the suggestion here is that, there's another way to go that's through accommodation and negotiation. You don't see it?
Well, that would be nice, again, to imagine that. I'm not against nice imaginations. I'm simply looking at the facts. And the fact is, and if we look at what Hamas itself has been saying in the last week, they have just stated a couple days ago that the secular era in Gaza ended. Islam will be triumph over the infidels. I'm quoting their statements. That's not me. As I said before, they have gone ahead and burned down a Christian covenant in Gaza. This is not what I wish to think one way or the other. These are facts. This happened. And so the point is, people change? Sure, let them show that they change. It's about facts. If they really have changed, if they're capable of change, let them show that to us. But so far, since this revolt has taken place, there has been little evidence of any change whatsoever on their part. And for one thing, because they're murdering their Palestinian brothers.
Augustus Richard Norton got some big questions and then some more granular ones as well. But what about the big framework that Mayrav Wurmser puts forward here? Her husband David Wurmser has written and spoken significantly sort of a similar view of the Middle East. Big agendas in Syria and Iran, then pushing very hard, finding success. We saw what happened in Lebanon last summer with Hezbollah. She writes in the Weekly Standard recently that, you know, they see the image here emerging of a U.S. as a country in retreat in this region, and they're out to take advantage of it on every front. Israel now with Hezbollah on its north, Hamas to the south. This notion of the whole eastern Mediterranean shore as a new battlefield for bigger agendas than just Hamas and the Palestinian. What do you say?
Well, specifically with reference to Iran, There's no question that Iran is in a much better geopolitical position today than it was a few years ago. It's not surprising. The U.S. has basically destroyed the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, which was an enemy of Iran. It has destroyed, the U.S. has destroyed the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And, of course, Iraq was the prime enemy of Iran. And, of course, the outcome of the war last summer between Lebanon, or between, I should say, Hezbollah and Israel, certainly resulted in a victory for Hezbollah, certainly an ally of Iran. So there's no question that Iran is feeling its oats, and led by a president with a sort of messianic approach to life. This is a matter of key concern. I spent 27 years of my life focusing on protecting the security of the United States, and I don't take this issue at all trivially.
Mehrav Hormuzer suggests it's not just a key concern, it's practically everything when you look at this situation.
Well, there are lots of other issues here, Tom, and you know, one of the things we need to keep in mind is it's not only groups and states that we don't like Iran and Syria, that influence events in the region, but we influence events in the region. Our response to the question of Palestine is very important in shaping the outcome. Many years ago, in 1993, when the so-called Oslo process was beginning, there was a choice in front of the United States and Israel, and that is what kind of Palestinian entity would be created in the West Bank and Gaza. And the choice was made to basically opt for protecting Israel, providing a kind of security state, a basic dictatorship under Arafat, rather than working to foster associational life, basically a more pluralistic Palestinian society, and so on. I remember one heated debate with Yossi Bilin, who I very much respect, one of the negotiators at Oslo. I said, Yossi, you're focusing on weapons. You should be focusing on the society you're making peace with. And he said, look, he said, the state of Palestine, this new state of Palestine, is going to be a dictatorship just like all the other Arab states. That kind of mindset has a big impact operationally in terms of what happens in a place like the West Bank and Gaza. We're not innocent of having shaped the situation in the direction in which it's moved.
Mr. Wormser, I'll come to you, but let me take a call first from Mehdi in Alexandria, Virginia. Mehdi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to bring a little realism into this. First of all, Iran makes a point of providing financial aid in a way that, is covert, and therefore it's not going from bank account to bank account. But everybody in the region knows that everyone in the region is using the Palestinians and the Lebanese for their own personal agendas. And Iran is the excellent spoiler. Iran is ruled by Hezbollah, and the leader of Hezbollah and Iran is Khamenei, not the president. That's a puppet show for the Western media to report on. And the fact of the matter is that Iran does things in a very deep-rooted way and a very systematic way, and we do things in a very superficial way. So that's why they keep winning.
So bring it back to Hamas then. If you're right, what does that suggest, Mehdi, about what U.S. policy ought to be, where it should lean when it comes to Hamas and the Palestinians now?
Well, the question is, do we want to deal with the real problem or the problems on the fringes? The real problem we have here is a real war between Iran and the United States. Even Syria would be neutralized without Iran. And because Iran started with Syria by providing financial aid, and then they got enough secrets about their politicians to be able to have a stick as well.
But let's say, if you're right, what's the answer? Is it to go hammer and tongs straight at Tehran? Or is it even if you're correct, is it, as Augustus Richard Norton suggests, go at a granular level at the problems one by one, and you may find support there for the U.S. rather than a juggernaut out of Tehran?
If we were serious about this issue, we would treat Iran like we treated the Soviet Union, and then put the same amount of resources in that, and it'll be worth it, because the longer we wait, the bigger problem we're going to have.
May Wormser, is that it? War with Iran, and let's get to it?
I don't think that we need to get to it. I think that they will do a nice job on their own of eventually forcing us to confront with them. So far, we're actually trying to offer them carrots more than sticks. And we're trying to talk to them and bring them around to the table, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not working so well. Why? Because they don't really want to cooperate. And that goes to the issue of actors wanting to change. Now, I wanted to talk about something that Augustus said, where I actually very much agree with him. I agree with him wholeheartedly that the problem with the Palestinian Authority that we have right now is, in a large, to a large extent, the result of the kind of games that Israel and the United States were playing at the time that the PA was created. We did not insist on a democratic government for Palestine. We did not insist on better life for the Palestinians, all of us. The end result was the creation of a dictatorship under Arafat that, on top of it all, was so corrupt that the people just ended up voting for Hamas. It could not have provided them with a better life. I am completely in agreement with Augustus on this point, and I do think that if there is anything wrong with American policy in the region, it is that we are not strong enough in our support for democracy and freedom, not the other way around.
You were a strong supporter of confronting Iraq. We've done that. It looks like a gigantic mess. Has it led you to any second thoughts about that kind of projection of democracy?
No, I don't think that the problem is with the idea of spreading democracy. I think that the problem was with the execution of the Iraq war. The problem was that we have not prepared an Iraqi government in exile, that we have not trained an Iraqi army and have given them the power to take over the country right there and then. The problem is that we're still there and we really don't need to be.
Didn't need to be. But I hear a kind of doubling up message in what you're saying, that this didn't work because we weren't, I don't know, strong enough, fierce enough, determined enough. I mean, is the inevitable logic of what you're saying that we start talking about Hamas and little Gaza Strip, and we end up talking about, are we back again to this regional or global confrontation with Iran? Do you see that as inevitable?
I see that as inevitable because of the Iranian intentions, not because of what we're doing. We know that they're going to go nuclear sometime in the future. We don't exactly know when. We know that they're not going nuclear just for the sake of being nuclear. They're going nuclear in order to threaten other regimes, not just Israel, but also possibly Saudi Arabia and others. This is a destabilizing effect right there and then. And beyond all of that, Iran is acting very aggressively in the region in trying to spread its influence and buy for itself all sorts of really radical clients everywhere, such as Hezbollah, which caused trouble in its name. I just don't think we have much of a choice on this. I think that Iran has decided that we're going to have a confrontation.
Okay, Augustus Richard Norton, now put yourself in the shoes of an ordinary American listening to this, trying to figure out where to throw their 2 cents. It's very difficult. On the one hand, you're saying, come on, let's get down and deal with Hamas, deal with real issues, sort of quality of life on the streets and lanes of Gaza Strip. Mayrav Wurmser pulls back and says, oh, no, there's a much, much bigger game afoot here. This is the equivalent of our confrontation with the Soviet Union. This is an existential threat. Forget about this, playing peanut small stuff with Hamas. That's a distraction. How do we begin to think about that chasm?
Well, first of all, Tom, we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Okay, that's a big stride and a big ball of gum.
That's right, and we have to take, I think, the advice of the caller Hadi, who made some very interesting points. He said, treat Iran like the Soviet Union. There's no question that Iran is an adversary of the U.S. What does that mean, to treat Iran like the Soviet Union? We engaged in a dialogue with the Soviet Union. Back in the 1980s, when I was teaching at West Point, I was involved in a number of dialogues with Russians in Moscow, in the States, and in other places, in Europe and so on, around issues of joint concern. These were informal, quiet dialogues, and actually it led to some very good results in the area of cooperation on peacekeeping, cooperation against terrorism, and so on. So basically, treating Iran like the Soviet Union in that respect is a darn good idea. In terms of the instant question, which is to say Hamas, look, the conditions under which people live their lives are crucial to understand. As I said in the opening to the show, over 80% of the Gazans are living below the poverty level. They can't even get good medicine. Most of the medicine that ends up in Gaza is near to expiration or expired. When we look at the casualty figures in Gaza, what we see is the number of people who are killed by gunfire. We don't take into account, for example, the number of people who die of illnesses that are curable simply because they can't get good medical care. We need to address that issue as well. We need to make sure that the quality of life in Gaza and the West Bank improves. That's urgent. Let me tell you, a few years ago, last time I was in Gaza, actually, a friend of mine who's a politician in Gaza, a straight guy as far as I know, we're driving through some of the camps. He's showing me some of the situation. We're talking about various things. And I asked him about the economic situation. He drove up in front of this big home belonging to Muhammad Dahlan, a home right
out of
Architectural Digest.
The U.S.-backed security chief, that home now torn to bits.
Exactly. And my friend looked at me, and we said one word in Arabic. He said, shuf. Look at that. Look at that. And that kind of said it. Here was this
But you need to explain the significance. This is a man that the U.S. supported the way, millions of dollars.
He's America's boy.
And now...
He's America's boy.
But we've read reports that mansion's just been torn apart right down to the bathroom tiles.
That's right. Right down to the Italian bathroom tiles and the gold faucets. It was the forces of Muhammad Dahlan that were defeated. Now, what's going on in Gaza is what Arabs call inshikak, a fissioning of the society, with all of these particles bouncing into each other. Nothing's going to happen instantly. There's no magic bullet, whether it's Hamas, Fatah, or any other group that's going to be able to make this a better society overnight. It's going to take a lot of time and patience. I say to former Prime Minister Blair, who's just taken on the task of being the representative for the quartet, and he's going to be focusing on economic and development questions. Good luck, and let's get moving to improve the quality of people's lives.
Let's hear from some listeners. Trelawney's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Trelawney, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Norton. It's always a pleasure to hear you speak. I had a couple points. Number one, when you demonize a whole group of people, it really makes it easy to ignore a lot of the things they're saying. And if you want to look at the facts, I think you need to look at all of the facts and say that, you know, a group doesn't change. Well, maybe a group doesn't change because a lot of things haven't changed outside. I agree with Dr. Norton that the only way to help this problem is to engage people. And the example that I think of instantly is obviously Northern Ireland, because no one would ever have imagined 30 years ago that Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness and all of the Sinn Féin leaders would be sitting, Gerry Adams would be sitting down together at a table the way they are right now.
So you think Tony Blair may have the model there as he heads to the Middle East? Think of Northern Ireland.
And if you read about, you know, the mathematics of terrorism by scholars who study the mathematics of terrorism, they show that if you kill 3 terrorists, you get 5 more terrorists or 10 more terrorists, and that if you engage people, then it does make them become more moderate over time as they become more pragmatic.
Trelawney, our time is short. We take your point. Let me get another call. Shalom from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Shalom.
Yes. Hello. I want to bring up a point which is crucial for understanding of Hamas, which was not brought up so far, to my surprise, or maybe I shouldn't be surprised, namely the deep religious roots and convictions both of Hamas and that applies also to Iran.
The Islamic fundamentalism that lies strong in Hamas.
Let me be more specific. In the facts and data and the two sacred books of Islam and Quran and the tradition and the Hadith. And there is this is the facts. And the deep religious roots are something which our secular minds maybe don't grasp. They are following the Prophet Muhammad, who entered a pact with the tribe of Quraysh, a pagan pact in Arabian Peninsula, and when it was convenient, after Hudna, armistice, the pact was broken, the tribe was destroyed. This is the first concept. The second concept is the concept of Taqiyya, which originally was ascribed just to Shiites, but it's accepted by most other Muslims, namely the concept it's all right to lie to the infidels, not just to kill them, but to lie them.
So you see no room for trust, no room for engagement. Is that it?
Part of the religious belief, lying to the infidels is permissible. Certainly killing them is permissible. The two other concepts. This is the question of the realm of Islam and the realm of the sword. Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb.
Shalom, I think we got that idea. I've just got a minute left here. Forgive me. Let me, Mayor of Wormser, turn to you just once more here. Where do you think actual policy is going to go? Do you think Washington will lean into an isolate Gaza, embrace West Bank policy explicitly soon?
Yes, I do. I don't think that that's incredibly it is going to yield incredible results over time. But I think that that is precisely what they're doing right now. I don't think that it's right for us to do that, not only because it's not going to work, but also because this is the democratic choice of the Palestinians. Why won't we respect their Palestinian people, democratic choice, voting for Hamas, and basically tell them, this is what you selected, this is what you live with.
Well, of course, the Gaza takeover was extra democratic, and at this point, so is the West Bank government, in a sense, an emergency government, but points made and big ones on all sides. Mayrov Wormser at the Hudson Institute, thank you very much for being with us. And Augustus Richard Norton from Boston University, thank you for joining us.
I always love being with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.